I'm standing on ice. I used to do this all the time, but ice in LA is pretty scarce, so it's been a couple of years. It is night. A cold wind blows ghosts of snow across the dark road. Cars crunch by through the darkness. I walk with unsteady steps across the road and down towards the water. My hands are buried in the pockets of my black overcoat, rescued from storage for the occasion. A musty scarf is wrapped around my neck, and I try to bury my face in its comforting folds. I'm wearing a Walkman, and my shaky fingers find the buttons and press play. Soon the moan of a cello fills my head, like a howling dog, like a train in the night, like every lovely, lonely sound ever made in the eternal darkness. And for the 100th time that day, tears squeeze themselves out of my eyes and roll stiffly down my cheeks. My father is dead. Two days earlier, he had walked across the snowy island of Kodiak to the mental health center. He used to joke that he had moved to Kodiak to die, but those of us that really knew him weren't laughing. It was still dark when he reached the door of the office where he counseled the island's residents and helped them to find a spark worth preserving, a light to follow out of the tunnel. It was not quite 6 in the morning, and nobody else would be there for at least another hour. He unlocked the door and walked upstairs to his office, which overlooked the empty parking lot. He put a piece of paper in his typewriter and wrote out a few last instructions, then turned the machine off. He looked around to make sure everything was in order. Satisfied, he reached into his pocket and pulled out his gun. He looked out again over the parking lot to the trees beyond, just starting to show themselves in the pale pre-dawn light. He stuck the gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. It's a story I could tell for the rest of my life, and in some senses, probably will. And it will never make any sense. I will never find all the loose ends and tie them together in a tidy package and put it away for safekeeping. My father was too complex, too hidden, too scattered to ever make a whole picture. He ended his life the way he lived it, on his own, the rest of the world be goddamned. And since I'm part of the rest of the world, God damn me too. I've always loved the cello, and when I had the opportunity to learn a string instrument, I should have signed up for cello, but I didn't. Talked out of the violin by my mother, who felt, correctly, that there were already too many violins in the world, I settled on the viola, the ugly stepsister of the flashy violin and the regal cello. A useful instrument, but not a beautiful one. The viola gets all the support jobs, but none of the glory. When I'd practice one of my orchestra parts, my mom would often ask if I was playing it correctly, because it didn't sound right to her. "Yes, I'm playing it right," I'd snap, bitter that I was relegated to keeping time or providing a bed of harmony over which the violin could skitter and gambol. Stupid viola. the cello. Now, there's an instrument. Deep, rich, luscious, like dark chocolate, the most romantic of all the instruments in the orchestra, the cello is capable of producing some of the most beautiful tones ever heard. And no one understands the inherent melodramatic power of the cello better than David Darling. I wouldn't be surprised if David Darling is not that well received in classical music circles. He has largely rejected the established repertoire and followed his own heart, creating a series of moody tone poems, often using unconventional techniques or instruments. He overdubs a lot and has been known to play the electric 8-string cello. He also played in the Paul Winter Consort, and that's his burnished tones you can hear playing counterpoint to Winter's oboe on their most recognized track, The Soaring Icarus. His large body of work peaked in 1992 with the release of what I consider his magnum opus, an album simply titled Cello. Throughout the album, he wrings the entire spectrum of human emotion out of his cello, although he focuses more on the deep blue, melancholic tones the instrument is so well suited for. Once, when I was in high school, I came home from school in the middle of the afternoon, sick as a dog, and fell into bed. I slept for a couple of hours and woke up in that strange, disorienting nap twilight in which you look at the clock and it says 4:30, but you have no idea what that means. It was winter and getting dark, and the whole world looked blue and empty from my room. Everything was still and quiet, and for a moment, I imagined I was the only person left on Earth. The darkness deepened, and still nothing broke the spell. After half an hour, a car slowly drove by in the distance, crunching on the snow, and I was snapped back into the world. David Darling's music sounds like that half hour to me. Still, quiet, blue, and profoundly alone. And no track raises the hair on my arm and cracks open my heart faster than In November. Thank you. especially the way that, near both the beginning and the end, over the stately progression of somber chords, there arises from the mists a shriek, a scream, a distant cry of unbearable loneliness. The piece ebbs and flows, the chords shifting and pulling, waxing and waning, swelling and subsiding. The harmonies drift, creating tension without dissonance, then slowly settle inexorably towards resolution. Closer and closer, darker and darker, until the final resolution is struck. In the shriek of grief, the threnody is released again, only to be swallowed by the ominous, omnipotent night. Turn back from the black water licking at the shore and head silently back to the hotel. I am in Kodiak, and my father is dead in November.